In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Donna Hoffman and Chris Larimer, professors of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Hi, Donna.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to Chris Larimer as well. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ben.
We want to invite our listeners this hour as well to join in. We have a half dozen or so items on the political landscape that we'd like to have analysis of from Donna and Chris. And we welcome your questions, your thoughts, as always, on Politics Day, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. A little bit later in the program, more than 10 months after the Iowa caucuses, seems like years ago because of the pandemic, well, the state Democratic Party issued a blistering report on the weekend. We'll talk about that in a few minutes and get Chris and Donna's thoughts on the future of Iowa's first in the nation status. Of course, we've long known that has been in jeopardy since what happened at the start of 2020. Also, analysis of the news surrounding the incoming and outgoing presidents. Let's start with this. Monday, electors in 50 states, also the District of Columbia, formally chose Joe Biden as the next president of the U.S. This comes 6 weeks after the election. Republicans in the Senate have begun to acknowledge the president-elect's victory. And also for the first time in recent days, Iowa's Republican senators, Charles Grassley, Joni Ernst, have acknowledged Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential election. Well, let's listen to the majority leader, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, congratulating President-elect Joe Biden, also Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, on the Senate floor, saying the Electoral College has spoken.
Many millions of us had hoped the presidential election would yield a different result. But our system of government has processes to determine who will be sworn in on January the 20th. The Electoral College has spoken. So today I want to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden. The President-elect is no stranger to the Senate. He's devoted himself to public service for many years. I also want to congratulate the Vice President-elect, our colleague from California, Senator Harris. Beyond our differences, all Americans can take pride that our nation has a female Vice President-elect for the very first time. I look forward to finishing out the next 36 days strong with President Trump. Our nation needs us to add another bipartisan chapter to this record of achievement.
Donna Hoffman, what do you think of those words of congratulations a number of weeks after the president-elect was declared the winner?
Well, you know, we should note there that Senator McConnell said, you know, the Electoral College has spoken. And indeed it has. The Electoral College, however, always speaks, as it were, in December. That's what federal law provides for. The electors meet on the first Monday after the second Wednesday in December, I believe, is the actual language that's there. That always happens. It's treated as a formality. But yet it took that long for a significant number of the opposition parties to recognize Biden as president-elect. And you know, one of the main reasons for that is that the president has not conceded the election. And so one of the jobs presidents also do is lead their party, and his fellow party members fell in line with much of the rhetoric that was coming out of the White House related to not conceding, but also, you know, asking for recounts, asking for or litigating in multiple states. Which we should note here, the Trump campaign had a very dismal record in that regard. They won one case out of 60 at last count that have gone through, and that one that they won merely related to some of the observations in a case in Pennsylvania, I believe it was. And so you know, this is a very unusual situation then, because typically, shortly after Election Day in November, even though we're voting for electors on Elector Day, we should, you know, add that the electors don't vote until mid-December, we call the president-elect, and that did not happen in this particular cycle, and that kind of signals the unusual nature of this this time period that we're living in.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer, your thoughts and what you think Mitch McConnell is doing there, trying to lead his party where in the coming weeks with this these words of congratulations?
Yeah, no, I agree with Donna. I think he's trying to balance, you know, reacting to the leader of his party, what the president has been saying about, you know, electoral fraud and waiting to see what happens with the Electoral College versus just trying to move on from what happened with the election. I mean, it's interesting that Mitch McConnell is certainly within his right to wait until the Electoral College formalizes this, the outcome, as Donna said, which the Electoral College did this last Monday. But, you know, you look at what President-elect Biden said on Monday night about trying to lower the lowering the temperature around politics right now. By not acknowledging what happened in November, Mitch McConnell and others allowed those temperatures to really flare up over a period of several weeks where they could have tried to calm things down. But by not really saying anything, by waiting for the Electoral College, waiting for, you know, kind of an unknown reason. Well, I mean, the reason is known, but really we didn't expect any surprises by what the Electoral College was doing. But by waiting that long, and rather than moving on to the new administration, they allowed those temperatures within the electorate to really flare up in a way that's going to make it hard for, I think, a lot of people to see the Biden administration as a legitimate administration. That it just prolongs that process in a way that really wasn't necessary. It really broke, as Donna said, with traditional norms of how we move from one presidency to another.
Right. And norms, I guess, is the question, Chris. Are Republicans in this cycle establishing the new normal for the conduct of elections, one in which a victory, and in this case, a Democratic victory, is suspect until proven otherwise, where Republicans in this case have a constitutional right, in their words, to challenge the vote in hopes of having it thrown out? Is that the real question here, Chris? Do you have an answer to that, if it is?
I don't know if I have an answer to it, but I think that's the real concern, is if that is the new norm, that creates a lot of problems in terms of conveying legitimacy to whoever wins an election and what happens on election night. If there is going to be constant suspicion surrounding election results that do not go your way, that presents a real problem, I think, going forward for democracy. That is, if this is the norm, just to raise suspicions when things don't go your way, even though we had election administrators in every state saying that there were no problems, that's a real problem for the electorate, because again, it raises this issue of legitimacy.
Mm-hmm. Donna, we were having a few dropouts on your phone. Are you still there?
I am still here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Oh, you're coming in clearer now. Let's
Great.
Proceed, and hopefully that's fixed. Let me share we don't have audio from our U.S. senators, but let me just share what they gave as acknowledgments after the Electoral College vote. When asked by reporters if it was time to acknowledge Biden as president-elect, our Senator Charles Grassley said, quote, "I don't have to. The Constitution does." He said, under the Constitution, that was decided by the Electoral College. Our other U.S. Republican Senator, Joni Ernst, asked about the Electoral College vote by reporters in Washington. Her quote, "Like it or not, I know for Iowans it's disappointing, but the process is what it is, and the Constitution will be followed." She was asked if that means Biden is president-elect. She said, if that's what the Electoral College decides today. That was obviously earlier on Monday. Donna, what do you make of the tone, the choice of wording of these acknowledgments and others by GOP leaders?
Well, you know, notably, none of them specifically use the term president-elect. So
right.
There's no soundbite, right, saying that they have called Biden the president-elect. There's some wishy-washiness there, if you will. I took a look back at some press releases from Senator Grassley's office in November of 2016 after the election. November 18th, there's one where and Grassley was chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time. Mm-hmm. He referred to President-elect Trump and the fact that he had was going to put forward Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. So that would come before the Judiciary Committee. There was another one on November 21st. Grassley even met with Sessions on November 29th, and Trump was referred to as President-elect. And again, the Electoral College votes in mid-December, and this has always been true. Now, maybe it was just that Trump was a Republican, but we can look back at a press release from November 25th of 2008, for example, when the 2008 election had elected Obama. And there's another press release from Grassley's office in November referring to Obama as president-elect. So the real variable here is the fact that the president has been behaving in a way that is just contra the norms of a general post-election season.
Mm-hmm. And why are the GOP leaders, in your view, Donna, paying attention, following the lead of this unconventional president still, it seems, for the most part?
I think they have a needle to thread here, right? They understand the realities of the electoral system, maybe perhaps even in a way that President Trump does not. But President Trump has a vocal minority of very strong followers. And the Republican office holders do not want to get crosswise with those followers. We can look at the various things happening even surrounding the electoral vote. Michigan, for example, because the electors vote in their state capitals, the Constitution tells us, Michigan shut down its state legislature, its Capitol building on Monday because of threats. Arizona didn't tell us where they were going to do their vote because of threats. We've had Republican office holders even say, more state or local ones, even say, I basically have to go along with this or my house might get bombed. So there's this tangible threat of violence out there that is, again, really, really unusual. The foundation of American elections is that they are free and fair. And much like sporting events take place across this country, mm-hmm. and much like parents everywhere put their children in sporting events to learn, you lose or you win. If you lose, you are a good sport, you acknowledge the winner, and you move on. That has really come into question in this particular election season, and that really undercuts the foundation of American democracy in a really pretty fundamental and really dangerous way.
If you just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Donna Hoffman and Chris Larimer, political scientists at the University of Northern Iowa. We'd enjoy your input as well. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Chris, back to something I'd like you to elaborate on after we listen to President-elect Biden from Monday evening. The words we'll hear from him spoken after the results of the Electoral College. In a 13-minute speech, the president-elect attacked the sitting president's attempts to overturn election results, though I don't think by name, in the form of multiple recounts and legal challenges. Let's listen to what Joe Biden had to say, a few moments of that.
Politicians don't take power. People grant power to them. One of the extraordinary things we saw this year was that everyday Americans, our friends and our neighbors, often volunteers, Democrats, Republicans, independents, demonstrating absolute courage. They showed a deep and unwavering faith in and a commitment to the law. They did their duty in the face of a pandemic. And then they could not and would not give credence to what they knew was not true. They knew this election was overseen by them, it was honest, it was free, and it was fair.
Chris Larimer, comment on the president-elect's reaction to these unusual circumstances over the past 6 weeks.
Yeah, I think it was interesting. You know, he's talking about political courage, and that political courage really started at the local level and worked its way up to the state level, whereas he said, and we've talked about, that Republican election officials at the state level, at the sub-state level, refused to give in to kind of external pressure or pressure from the federal government, particularly pressure from the president, to say that somehow the election results were fraudulent or corrupt. Mm-hmm. They were willing to stand up for that. And that political courage really started at the local level. And he's making that point, and I think, you know, more generally back to what I mentioned earlier about the temperature in politics right now, we know how polarized the electorate is, and the rhetoric that the president has been using for several weeks since the election, and in many cases where you have Republican U.S. Republican senators not willing or unwilling to address that rhetoric, unwilling to take positions that could help lower the temperature, the president-elect is really put in a difficult position, because that feeling within the electorate has really been allowed to just continue on, not just stopping on election day, but continuing for several weeks after the election, to the point where now, as Donna mentioned, you know, you have concerns about violence, concerns about violence against individuals who are working for elections, or violence against electors. And I think those 6 weeks were critical to lowering the temperature, and the president did nothing to do that. And going forward, the question is it still possible to do that? Is it still possible to pull back those feelings surrounding the election? And I think, you know, we potentially missed a really critical window to be able to do that.
Yeah. President Trump has really put our democratic system through a stress test. This is generally acknowledged, President Trump and those who have followed his lead. Donna, I wonder if you feel this is sort of, we've reached the apex of the stress test, that it looks like it will be calming down now, and that the institutions, the courts, the election system has held.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the next step in this process, because, as you know, Americans now know pretty thoroughly that this is a multi-step process. The Congress will meet in a joint session on January 6th, where they will receive those certificates, those ballots that the electors cast on Monday. During that joint session, Vice President Pence, will preside as president of the Senate. They will read through the electoral votes from all the states. The members of Congress have an opportunity at that point to object to the certification of those states. We saw some of this in 2016. There were several Democratic members of the House of Representatives that had objected. At the point in 2016 that this was happening, Joe Biden was president of the Senate. For these objections to go forward, they have to also have a senator sign on to them. No senators in 2016 signed off on those objections, so they did not go anywhere. McConnell was quoted in the media yesterday also as trying to lower the temperature of the Senate conference, the Republican conference in the Senate, asking them not to sign on to any of those coming out of the House, because we know that there's probably going to be some of those coming out of the House. Mo Brooks from Alabama has said he already potentially will do that. As long as no senators sign on to that, that they will stop at that point. However, if a senator does, the two chambers will have to go back and debate and vote on those objections, and that will take time. We saw this actually happen in after the 2004 election, but of course then those objections didn't go anywhere. So I just want to throw that in as, yes, there still could be a little bit more drama, but those are not going to go anywhere, but there would just be drama for drama's sake, essentially. But to your question of the stress test, the system definitely has been stressed, and I think people will disagree on whether the institutions held that well or not. Now, the purpose of doing a stress test in, say, a business environment or any other kind of environment, right, is to find the weaknesses in a system, and then presumably when those weaknesses are found, to fix those weaknesses. We saw this after the 2000 presidential election, right, because of different ballots used in Florida. Congress passed the Help America Vote Act to help fix that system. And so will we see state legislatures making it easier for people to vote, or maybe even harder for people to vote in their states, based on this stress test that the election has gone through? That's an open question. Will we see Congress do any legislation to address some of the issues that have been shown in this particular election season? That's the real question. So, yes, it is. I do think it is a stress test. I do think largely the institutions have held, but it also shows us a number of weaknesses. If this election had been closer, because it really wasn't that close, if it had been closer, this could really have been a much bigger problem. And we need to deal with these issues before that closer election comes to us.
Okay. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. A couple minutes before a break, let's go to a caller, Betty, joining us from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Betty. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
We have just a couple minutes before the break. I'll ask you to be brief. Welcome.
Okay. I wanted to comment on Senator Grassley not acknowledging President-elect Biden. He made a very change in his personality and how he deals with politics the minute the Koch Brothers Association brought their money into Iowa to help elect Joni Ernst. And he has been told by the party how to do things and is towing their line. In addition to money for her election, he has been promised money for the election of his grandson to the Senate when he leaves the Senate.
Okay, Betty in Cedar Rapids, thank you very much. Comment from either our political analysts to Betty's comment there? Okay. Yes. Was that you, Chris?
Yes. I can't speak to the promise that she mentioned. I don't know about that. But, I think it gets at what Donna was mentioning about the stress test and about the institutions. And I think there are logistical things that can be done to strengthen the system, to use Donna's point. But the other side of that stress test is attitudinal and feelings within the electorate. And the way you correct those generally start with the rhetoric from leaders. And so until leaders within both parties are willing to kind of change the rhetoric that they're using, change this discussion about election fraud, which is really sort of this kind of mythical discussion, because election administrators in state after state have said that there was no fraud. Until that rhetoric changes, then I don't know if you can change the attitudes within the electorate. And that's, I think, the really difficult part of this stress test.
All right. And the rhetoric changing doesn't seem to depend on facts on the ground, Chris, because as you pointed out,
right,
we have plenty of facts, plenty of reports that our election did not have any widespread fraud in any sense of the word.
Right, and that's the real challenge. As you said, there are facts on the ground, and this can get back to conversations people have had about just facts, science, expertise in general. And if people are taking their cues from leaders, and those leaders are objecting to generally agreed upon facts, that becomes very difficult to sort of move forward or move ahead with anything within the system.
Okay, we'll have to take a break, and we'll be back with more analysis from Chris Larimer and Donna Hoffman, professors of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. It's Politics Wednesday. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll talk about the Biden climate team, which has been announced in recent days. Get Donna and Chris's thoughts on that. Also, we're going to time travel back to a year ago, well, almost a year, when we were leading up to the Iowa caucuses, and talk about what happened actually on caucus day and the days afterwards, and the implications for any future Iowa caucuses. It's a Politics Wednesday edition. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Once upon a midnight weary, artists of Iowa discovered something quite dreary. In a pandemic year, an evil villain is out to steal the holiday cheer.
No live entertainment? Get out! No way! I'll save it myself if I have to. I'll do it today.
Join Iowa Public Radio Studio 1 and XBK for The Holiday Special, an original musical for a pandemic year, at 7 p.m. on Sunday, December 20th.
So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a Politics Wednesday edition. Our analysts today, Donna Hoffman and Chris Larimer, political scientists at the University of Northern Iowa, both professors of political science. We invite you to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. And we want to talk about President-elect Biden's latest announcements in just a moment as far as cabinet members. But let's continue on, I assume, from our conversation last half hour with Ann in Cedar Rapids. Welcome to the program. Thank you for waiting, Ann.
Hi. I hope you can hear me. You ended up kind of blanking out here.
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead, Ann.
Great. I'd like to say that I don't think people realized how close our country came to experiencing a coup. This is very reminiscent, actually, of early Nazi Germany, where they, which led to the Beer Hall Putsch, which Hitler was jailed and then wrote Mein Kampf, and then his second attempt, he succeeded. We came very close to losing our democracy because of the Republican leadership not acknowledging the transfer of power and instead trying to rally the troops in being aggressive and denying what actually happened, the truth.
Okay, so, and let's get we have other callers. Let's get reaction to that. Donna, what do you think of Anne's great concern there?
Well, actually, there's been a debate among political scientists and others as to whether this is properly a coup or not. And I'll leave that to academic debates. But it certainly is a point, again, going back to that issue we were talking about in the last half hour about the stress test. We see where there are stresses in the system, and the big challenge is whether we will go on to other things now or whether we will seriously address, and we being here, the people through their elected representatives, both in state legislatures as well as the Congress, whether we will address the issues to shore this system up. Because, again, this wasn't a particularly close election at the end of the day. But we have had, even in recent memories, some really close elections, 2000, for example. And will we do anything to try to shore that up? And again, will leaders, to Chris's earlier comment, will leaders take a lesson from this to be more diplomatic in terms of their language, to lower that temperature in times where things tend seem to be flaring up?
Okay. Ann, thanks for that call from Cedar Rapids. Let's go to Keegan. Keegan in Iowa City. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. So as you were talking about earlier about this stress test on the electorate itself, my question is, what responsibility does the media have in reporting on Trump's false claims? Especially when he's no longer president, how much attention should be paid to him? Because even with fact-checking and clarifying that the claims are false, they still serve to amplify them and even vindicate the belief of some of the people who buy into them.
Right, Keegan. Chris, let me toss this your way. I'm, of course, part of the media here, too. I'll just say that, you know, when the president says something, it's hard for any media source to turn that down. The president, this president, has said so many things that have been reported on, also ones that have not been reported on. Chris, what are your thoughts for Keegan's question as well?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think, as you said, Ben, you know, when the president speaks, the media does have a responsibility to cover that. But as we've seen over these last few weeks, as the president has continued his rhetoric on election fraud, what we've seen from some media organizations is either discontinuing the coverage of the president while he's giving one of those press conferences, you know, talking on Twitter, labeling it as misleading or not factual, some of those statements. And so I think the media is pushing back. It seems to be a little bit more in recent weeks as state election officials have said that there was no fraud. And then if you hear the president saying there was fraud, we've seen media organizations pushing back pretty hard on that. But I, you know, it's a difficult question. Like I said, I think the country really missed an opportunity these last several weeks from the election period until now where we could have sort of reset how voters think about elections. The real concern here is with these last several weeks, have voters really had a complete reset of how they think about elections so that now going forward, there is always going to be suspicion about elections. I think we could have, you know, tried to get in front of that mindset a little bit over the last several weeks with, particularly with leaders in Congress, could have done more to do that. The concern now is, you know, has this permanently reset how voters are going to think and view the operations of elections?
Donna, let me ask.
Go ahead,
please, Donna. Go ahead.
Can I just add there? You know, we've seen an interesting phenomenon as Facebook
became unpalatable to some, they moved to Parler. As Fox started to be a little bit more conventional in some of its reporting, Newsmax and OANN gained, you know, viewers. So we want to put a little bit of onus here on citizens as well to be good citizens in that they are getting their information from reliable, reputable, and even multiple sources, and weighing those kinds of things carefully. So we don't want to leave citizens out of that kind of responsibility equation there as well.
Right. And it's an interesting, the question from Keegan also is interesting in when he talked about the post presidency period of Donald Trump, how much the media will be covering him. Now, he will want to have as big a megaphone as he can, it seems, Donna. He will want to influence the Republican Party, and from what we can see, he will be a significant influence on it. But I think that would fade, don't you think, Donna, the coverage of the president if he continues with a lot of false claims once out of office?
Well, I think in some quarters it will fade, correct, but again, covering Donald Trump has been really lucrative for some of these news outlets, and, you know, amplifying his tweets in some of these, you know, newer outlets that I mentioned may in fact be a strategy that they go with because they will get some viewers by doing that. So, you know, yes, I think by and large, Trump will try to not fade from the scene. He's already, you know, talking about a run again in 2024. I think at some point the Republican Party will have to have a grappling, because there are other people within the Republican Party that want to run in 2024. They will have to have a grappling of how they're going to treat this. I think the jury's still out on how they do it, but they are going to definitely have to figure out what their strategy is going to be for dealing with a post-president who's probably not going to be quiet.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty safe bet. I think we can all agree on that. Let's give a few moments to a couple of other items on our political landscape. President-elect Biden announcing members of his climate team, or thoughts on that. The president-elect expected to pick Gina McCarthy, former EPA chief, as White House climate coordinator. Jennifer Granholm, the former Michigan governor, said to be his choice for the Energy Department. And we just heard, as we've been speaking, or just prior to this program, Biden formally introducing Pete Buttigieg as his nominee for Transportation Secretary, a role that's going to be really key in advancing the president-elect's ambitious agenda on the nation's infrastructure, also on climate change. Chris, thoughts on these latest names and how you think the Biden team is taking shape overall?
Well, I think what we've seen overall is that he is very committed to establishing a very diverse cabinet and administration. He continues to do that with appointments that come out each week. You know, we can add to that climate team. You know, he appointed John Kerry as special presidential envoy for the climate, or for climate. You know, that it's essentially a cabinet level position, but it's not going to require Senate confirmation. And so it just shows you that, you know, the President-elect Biden throughout the campaign talked about climate change, talked about it as one of the fundamental issues of the administration going forward, in addition to dealing with the economy and the pandemic, of course, that climate change, or just addressing climate issues, is going to be key to this administration. And with those appointments, he's making that point.
Mm-hmm. Donna, is the president-elect, as far as you can see, keeping both the moderate and progressive wings of the Democratic Party satisfied?
Well, there's always going to be people who want things that the president-elect's not going to be able to do. But and I think he, you know, throughout his career has usually kind of resisted those pressures to take a pretty moderate track. But, you know, we should note that he told us he would want to elevate certain issues like climate change. He told voters that he wanted a cabinet that looked more like the diversity of America. Pete Buttigieg, if he's confirmed by the Senate, will be the first openly gay individual serving in the cabinet. And so There is always going to be, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking during a lame duck session when the president-elect is doing these various things. And various groups are going to have to compromise in some ways. And that's kind of the nature of the beast here. But yet again, you know, it is things to report on and to talk about as we speculate about, you know, whether these people can be confirmed, et cetera, as we go through this kind of transition period.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it's undeniable that the approach that the Biden team takes to the climate issue, the climate crisis, will depend on what the control of the Senate. It stays in Democratic hands. The House does, albeit with a thinner margin there, Nancy Pelosi. But in the Senate, we have two Senate runoff elections, January 5th, the president-elect Biden campaigning in Georgia yesterday. Now, to win control, the Democrats need to defeat both of the state's incumbent Republican senators, David Perdue, Kelly Loeffler, intense national attention, and so much cash at these in these races. Perdue facing John Ossoff, while Loeffler being challenged by the Reverend Raphael Warnock, a senior pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, which alone has a tremendous amount of significance. Chris, quickly, before we move on, your view of what's happening in Georgia, we'll be looking at that over the next couple of weeks. Do you have any feeling or interesting aspects of that race, that campaign, before we move on, Chris?
Well, I would say two things relatively briefly. One, I mean, it still appears to be a very tight race, generally within the margin of error. If you look at, 538, they have both races within about a percentage point. The big caveat here is that we know from polling this cycle that there was a considerable underestimation of support for the president. And so there's a question about are they underestimating support for the, does that continue for those two Georgia races where they're underestimating support for the two Republican candidates? To your larger point, though, about public policy, this is what we talk about in policy classes. We talk about, there's a classic theory on policy windows. And what that tells us is that if you have what scholars talk about is the three streams lining up, where there's a recognition of a problem, there's a clear solution, and then the political stream lines up, you can see significant policy change. If these two Senate seats in Georgia would turn flip to being Democrat so that Democrats would have unified control of the federal government, that would create a significant policy window for the Biden administration. And there's some speculation about whether or not he would use that window to push through a big change on climate policy, because these windows can close relatively quickly. I mean, if you look back to 2008 when Obama was elected, mm-hmm. the big thing he pushed through in 2009 was health care change and the Affordable Care Act. So if those two seats flip in Georgia, does the Biden administration use that as a window to push through significant climate change policy?
Okay, we only have about 5 minutes left. I want to go to one more area. Donna, I want to rely on you to take the lead on this one. Last year at this time, our political world was much different. No COVID, no attempted election subversion, no talk about how our democratic system seems to be on shaky footing, no worries about civil unrest to the extent that we have it today, or even civil war or a coup or anything like that. We were counting down to the Iowa caucuses 1 year ago, and Joe Biden was anything but a favorite for the Democratic nomination. We had the top polling people there, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Bernie Sanders, if you remember that. Then came the disastrous caucus process showing in February, delayed results for days. Last weekend, the Iowa Democratic Party sought to, I guess, shift some blame onto the Democratic National Committee. This is more than 10 months after this first-in-the-nation nominating contest. Donna, tell us about this report that came out on the weekend.
Sure. Well, this is a report that was commissioned by the Iowa Democratic Party. It was conducted by a couple of law firms active in Des Moines. And they did a pretty thorough investigation of what went wrong. And, the most of the blame falls on the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. But the Iowa Democratic Party gets a little bit of blame here as well. But, for the most part, This is a really interesting report. Now, it's very technical. It's not, you know, nighttime reading for most people, but it is very methodical in terms of how they go through this process. And, you know, of course, I'm a political nerd. I found it very interesting. They did determine, you know, there's no hacking. That was one of the concerns, especially with the app. The app was slow to roll out. The training was problematic on it. Part of the reason the app was slow to roll out was that the DNC inserted itself in that process. You know, we started off with the DNC after the last election, changing the rules that the Iowa Democratic Party had to fulfill. That was really very difficult because the Democratic Party nationally would really like to see caucuses go the way of the dinosaur. And yet the Iowa Democrats want, and Republicans too, for that matter, right, want to keep the Iowa caucuses as first in the nation. And so this put a lot of pressure and a lot of stress on the Iowa Democratic Party. And most of that stress came from the Democratic National Committee itself. And so this, and you know, there was technical issues with the app, but part of that was exacerbated by the fact that the DNC decided they wanted to see the raw numbers. They used a different coding language than Shadow, the company that did the app, and that caused problems. That was the main reason why we did not get results on the evening of the caucuses. What they had was largely correct, but there was a coding glitch that caused the DNC to raise a red flag and say, we see irregularities, you need to stop. And then, of course, the Iowa Democrats did, and we got the, you know, the post-caucus issue of who won that people always want to know, right? There are also recommendations in this report, and these are very important for the Democratic Party to assess going forward. The real issue here is going to be, what are the implications of this for the future for the Iowa caucuses? This concerns Republicans, too, as well. You know, in the past, what has kept the Iowa caucuses first has been that the other 48 states, I'll exclude New Hampshire here, couldn't agree on a different system. You know, perhaps what the 2020 caucuses did was actually make one thing that everybody else can agree on, and that is that Iowa should not go first any longer. And that is going to be a real bar that both parties in the state are going to have to combat in the coming years as the system gets set up for 2024.
Mm-hmm. Chris, your thoughts in a moment, but let's remind ourselves that Iowa's first in the nation status was in jeopardy even before what happened in February of this year. Let's listen to the words of Julian Castro, recorded in November of 2019. This part of an interview with the former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and he was also a presidential candidate, not doing too well at the time I think this interview was recorded, defending his remarks on Iowa's early state status being first in the nation. Here are his criticisms.
We do need to change the order of the states, because I don't believe that that we're the same country we were in 1972. That's when Iowa first held its caucus first. And by the time we have the next presidential election in 2024, it'll have been more than 50 years since 1972. Our country has changed a lot in those 50 years. The Democratic Party has changed a lot. What I really appreciate about Iowans and the folks in New Hampshire is that they take this process very seriously. Mm-hmm. They vet the candidates, they show up at town halls, they give people a good hearing. At the same time, demographically, it's not reflective of the United States as a whole, certainly not reflective of the Democratic Party, and I believe that other states should have their chance. So yes, of course, we need to find other states. And that doesn't mean that Iowa and New Hampshire can't still play an important role,
right?
But I don't believe that forever we should be married to Iowa and New Hampshire going first. And that's just the truth of the way that I see it.
Okay, we have just under 2 minutes left. Chris, you first. With remarks like that, criticisms like that, how much jeopardy do you see for the Iowa caucuses going forward?
Well, I certainly think that the report has done nothing to ease those concerns about Iowa's chances for 2024 as far as being first in the nation, particularly for the Democratic caucuses. I mean, you know, as Donna mentioned, there are recommendations in the report. They talk about continuing the need to try to expand participation for the caucuses, to reforming the Democratic caucuses so they're similar, and they even write in the recommendations similar to what the Republican Party uses for their caucuses as far as a basic sort of straw poll ballot. And then one of the other recommendations is trying to manage media expectations, which is going to be extraordinarily difficult. So So I think, the report does nothing to ease concerns about whether or not Iowa is going to go first for the Democratic caucuses in 2024. I think there are still significant changes that need to be made. And I completely agree with Donna that, if anything, the report has just sort of consolidated that feeling that, you know, the way that the Iowa Democratic caucuses work is just no longer working for the way Americans view elections and the desire to have election results immediately in the operations of elections.
Mm-hmm. 20 or 30 seconds left. Donna, would you like to chime in with some closing words?
Well, let's remember, going back to Secretary Castro's remarks, nobody designed the system to be the way it is. It's an accident of history that Iowa went first in 1972. And that is one of the problems, right? Nobody would design a system rationally the way that we have it. But that is the problem with decentralized nominations in the United States, just with like decentralized elections in the United States, is that the states have a lot of purview here. The national parties have some measure of control here, but the states can ignore the national party, and it is very, very complex. And nobody would design a system to be the way that it is, but the other states have not been able to agree on a different system.
Okay, Donna Hoffman and Chris Larimer, thank you very much. We've run out of time. Donna and Chris are professors of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Chris, Donna, until next time, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Tomorrow we'll talk about the fight against food insecurity made worse by the pandemic and the economic fallout there. That's tomorrow on the program, one of our topics. I'm Ben Kiefer, River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for tuning in.